For the first time, I began to think something would be done about whites killing, beating, and misusing Negroes. I knew I was going to be a part of whatever happened. A week before summer school ended, I was in town shopping with Rose, a girl from the dorm. We had planned to split a cab fare back to campus, but discovered we did not have enough money. Cab fare out to Tougaloo was $2.50, and bus fare was 35 cents one way. We decided to take the trailways back. When we got to the station, I suggested to Rose that we use the white side. "I'm game if you are," she said. I walked in the white entrance. When I looked back, I saw that Rose had not followed. I decided I would not go back to see what had happened because she would try and talk me out of it. As I was buying my ticket, she walked up behind me.
"Shit, Moody, I thought you were kidding," she said.
I didn't answer. I was noticing the reaction of the man behind the counter. He stood looking at me as if he were paralyzed.
"Make that 2 tickets, please," I said to him.
"Where is the other one to?" he said.
"Both to Tougaloo," I said. As he was getting the tickets for us, another man had gotten on the phone. He kept looking at us as he was talking. I think he was reporting to the police what was taking place. The man that sold us the tickets acted as if that was the last thing in the world he wanted to do. He slapped the tickets down on the counter and threw the change at me. The change fell off the counter and rolled over to the floor. That bastard had the nerve to laugh as we picked it up. Rose and I sat opposite each other so we could see what was happening throughout the terminal. The bus was to leave at 3:30, and we had gotten there about 2:45. We had some time to wait. Rose had a watch. I asked her to keep a check on the time. People came in and stared. Some even laughed. Nothing happened until a bunch of white soldiers sat with us and started talking. The conversation had gone on for some time when a Negro woman got off one of the incoming buses. She saw us sitting in there and walked right in. She had about 6 small children with her. The little Negro children started running around the station, picking up things from the counter and asking if they could buy them. At that point, the excitement started. A drunken white man walked into the station behind the Negro lady with all the children. He started cursing, calling us all kinds of niggers.
"Get them little dirty swines out of here," he said, pulling one of the little boys to the door.
"Take your filthy hands off my child," the Negro woman said. "What's going on here anyway?"
"They got a place for you folks. Now why don't you take them chillins of yours and go on right over there?" the drunkard said, pointing to the Negro side of the bus station.
The lady looked at us. I guess she wanted us to say something. Rose and I just sat there. Finally, she realized a sit-in or something was going on. She took her children and hurried out of the door. Instead of going to the Negro side, she went back on the bus. She looked as though she was really angry with us. After that, the drunkard started yelling at us. I didn't get too scared, but Rose was now shaking. She had begun to smoke cigarettes one after the other. She looked at her watch.
"Moody, we must have missed the bus," she said.
"What time is it?" I asked.
"It's almost 4:30.
"They didn't even announce that the bus was loading," I said.
I walked over to the man at the ticket counter.
"Has the bus come in that's going to Tougaloo?"
I asked him.
"One just left," he said.
"You didn't announce that the bus was in."
"Are you telling me how to do my job?" he said. "I hear you niggas at Tougaloo think you run Mississippi."
"When is the next bus?" I asked.
5:30, he said, very indignant.
I went back and told Rose that the next bus left at 5:30. She wanted to leave. But I insisted that we stay. Just as I was trying to explain to her why we should not leave, the white drunk walked up behind her. He had what appeared to be a wine bottle in his hand. "Talk to me, Rose," I said.
"What's going on?"
Rose said, almost shouting.
"Nothing. Stop acting so damn scared and start talking," I said.
The drunk walked up behind her and held the bottle up as though he was going to hit her on the head. All the time I was looking him straight in the face as if to say,
"Would you? Would you really hit her?"
Rose knew someone was behind her. She wouldn't have been able to talk or act normal if someone in the station threatened to shoot her if she didn't. The drunkard saw that I was pleading with him. He cursed me, throwing the bottle on the floor and breaking it. At this point, more people got all rallied up. They had now started shouting catcalls from every direction. Some bus drivers walked into the station.
"What's wrong? What's going on here?"
one of them shouted. One took a chair and sat right in front of us.
"Do you girls want to see a show?" he said. "Did you come here for a little entertainment?"
We didn't say anything.
"I guess you didn't. I'll put it on anyhow," he said. "Now here's how white folks entertain."
Putting his thumbs in his ears and wiggling his fingers, kicking his feet, and making all kind of facial expressions. The rest of the whites in the bus station laughed and laughed at him. Some asked him to imitate a monkey, Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers. His performance went on for what seemed to be a good 30 minutes. When he finished, or rather got tired of, clowning, he said,
"Now some of you other people give them what they really came for."
All this time the man was still on the phone talking to someone. We were sure he was talking to the police. Some of the other people that were sitting around in the bus station started shouting remarks. I guess they were taking the advice of the bus driver. Again, Rose looked at her watch to report that we had missed the second bus. It was almost 7:15. We didn't know what to do. The place was getting more tense by the minute. People had now begun to crowd around us.
"Let's go, Moody," Rose began to plead with me. "If you don't, I'll leave you here," she said.
I knew she meant it, and I didn't want to be left alone. The crowd was going to get violent any minute now.
"Okay, Rose, let's go," I said. "Don't turn your back to anyone, though."
We got up and walked backward to the door. The crowd followed us just 3 or 4 feet away. Some were threatening to kick us out or throw us all the way to Tougaloo, and a lot of other possible and impossible things. Rose and I hit the swinging doors with our backs at the same time. The doors closed immediately behind us. We were now outside the station, not knowing what to do or where to run. We were afraid to leave. We were at the back of the station and thought the mob would be waiting for us if we ran around in front and tried to leave. Any moment now, those that had followed us would be on us again. We were standing there just going to pieces.
"Get in this here car," a Negro voice said.
I glanced to one side and saw that Rose was getting into the back seat. At that moment, the mob was coming toward me through the doors. I just started moving backward until I fell into the car. The driver sped away. After we had gotten blocks away from the station, I was still looking out of the back window to see who would follow. No one had. For the first time, I looked to see who was driving the car and asked the driver who he was. He said he was a minister, that he worked at the bus station part-time. He asked us not to ever try and sit in again without first planning it with an organization.
"You girls just can't go around doing things on your own," he said.
He drove us all the way to campus, then made us feel bad by telling us he probably would get fired. He said he was on a 30-minute break. That's a Negro preacher for you. Summer school ended the following week. I headed for New Orleans to get that good 3 weeks of work in before the fall term of my senior year began. Part 4. The Movement. Chapter 22. In mid-September, I was back on campus, but didn't very much happen until February, when the NAACP held its annual convention in Jackson. They were having a whole lot of interesting speakers: Jackie Robinson, Floyd Patterson, Kurt Flood, Margarita Belafonte, and many others. I wouldn't have missed it for anything. I was so excited that I sent one of the leaflets home to Mama and asked her to come. 3 days later, I got a letter from Mama with dried-up tears on it, forbidding me to go to the convention. It went on for more than 6 pages. She said if I didn't stop that shit, she would come to Tougaloo and kill me herself. She told me about the time I last visited her on Thanksgiving, and she had picked me up at the bus station. She said she picked me up because she was scared some white in my hometown would try to do something to me. She said the sheriff had been by, telling her I was messing around with that NAACP group. She said he told her if I didn't stop it, I could not come back there anymore. He said that they didn't need any of those NAACP people messing around in Centerville. She ended the letter by saying that she had burned the leaflet I sent her. "Please, don't send any more of that stuff here. I don't want nothing to happen to us here," she said. "If you keep that up, you will never be able to come home again." I was so damn mad after her letter. I felt like taking the NAACP convention to Centerville. I think I would have if it had been in my power to do so. The remainder of the week, I thought of nothing except going to the convention. I didn't know exactly what to do about it. I didn't want Mama or anyone at home to get hurt because of me. I had felt something was wrong when I was home. During the 4 days I was there, Mama had tried to do everything she could to keep me in the house. When I said I was going to see some of my old classmates, she pretended she was sick and said I would have to cook. I knew she was acting strangely, but I hadn't known why. I thought Mama just wanted me to spend most of my time with her, since this was only the second time I had been home since I entered college as a freshman. Things kept running through my mind after that letter from Mama. My mind was so active I couldn't sleep at night. I remember the one time I did leave the house to go to the post office. I had walked past a bunch of white men on the street on my way through town, and one said, "Is that the gal going to Tougaloo?" He acted kind of mad or something, and I didn't know what was going on. I got a creepy feeling, so I hurried home. When I told Mama about it, she just said, "A lot of people don't like that school." I knew what she meant. Just before I went to Tougaloo, they had housed the Freedom Riders there. The school was being criticized by whites throughout the state. The night before the convention started, I made up my mind to go, no matter what Mama said. I just wouldn't tell Mama or anyone from home. Then it occurred to me, how did the sheriff or anyone at home know I was working with the NAACP chapter on campus? Somehow they had found out. Now I knew I could never go to Centerville safely again. I kept telling myself that I didn't really care too much about going home, that it was more important to me to go to the convention. I was there from the very beginning. Jackie Robinson was asked to serve as moderator. This was the first time I had seen him in person. I remembered how when Jackie became the first Negro to play Major League Baseball, my uncles and most of the Negro boys in my hometown started organizing baseball leagues. It did something for them to see a Negro out there playing with all those white players. Jackie was a good moderator, I thought. He kept smiling and joking. People felt relaxed and proud. They appreciated knowing and meeting people of their own race who had done something worth talking about. When Jackie introduced Floyd Patterson, heavyweight champion of the world, the people applauded for a long, long time. Floyd was kind of shy. He didn't say very much. He didn't have to. Just his being there was enough to satisfy most of the Negroes who had only seen him on TV. Archie Moore was there, too. He wasn't as smooth as Jackie, but he had his way with a crowd. He started telling how he was run out of Mississippi, and the people just cracked up. I was enjoying the convention so much that I went back for the night session. Before the night was over, I had gotten autographs from every one of the Negro celebrities. I had counted on graduating in the spring of 1963, but as it turned out, I couldn't because some of my credits still had to be cleared with Natchez College. A year before, this would have seemed like a terrible disaster, but now I hardly even felt disappointed. I had a good excuse to stay on campus for the summer and work with the movement, and this was what I really wanted to do. I couldn't go home again anyway, and I couldn't go to New Orleans. I didn't have money enough for bus fare. During my senior year at Tougaloo, my family hadn't sent me one penny. I had only the small amount of money I had earned at Maple Hill. I couldn't afford to eat at school or live in the dorms, so I had gotten permission to move off campus. I had to prove that I could finish school, even if I had to go hungry every day. I knew Raymond and Miss Pearl were just waiting to see me drop out. But something happened to me as I got more and more involved in the movement. It no longer seemed important to prove anything. I had found something outside myself that gave meaning to my life. I had become very friendly with my social science professor, John Salter, who was in charge of NAACP activities on campus. All during the year, while the NAACP conducted a boycott of the downtown stores in Jackson, I had been one of Slater's most faithful canvassers and church speakers. During the last week of school, he told me that sit-in demonstrations were about to start in Jackson and that he wanted me to be the spokesman for a team that would sit in at Woolworth's lunch counter. The two other demonstrators would be classmates of mine, Memphis and Perlina. Perlina was a dedicated NAACP worker, but Memphis had not been very involved in the movement on campus. It seemed that the organization had had a rough time finding students who were in a position to go to jail. I had nothing to lose, one way or the other. Around 10 o'clock the morning of the demonstrations, NAACP headquarters alerted the news services. As a result, the police department was also informed. But neither the policemen nor the newsmen knew exactly where or when the demonstrations would start. They stationed themselves along Capitol Street and waited. To divert attention from the sit-in at Woolworth's, the picketing started at JCPenney's a good 15 minutes before. The pickets were allowed to walk up and down in front of the store three or four times before they were arrested. At exactly 11 a.m., Perlina, Memphis, and I entered Woolworth's from the rear entrance. We separated as soon as we stepped into the store and made small purchases from various counters. Perlina had given Memphis her watch. He was to let us know when it was 11:14. At 11:14, we were to join him near the lunch counter, and at exactly 11:15, we were to take seats at it. Seconds before 11:15, we were occupying three seats at the previously segregated Woolworth's lunch counter. In the beginning, the waitresses seemed to ignore us, as if they really didn't know what was going on. Our waitress walked past us a couple of times before she noticed we had started to write our own orders down and realized we wanted service. She asked us what we wanted. We began to read to her from our order slips. She told us that we would be served at the back counter, which was for Negroes. "We would like to be served here," I said. The waitress started to repeat what she had said, then stopped in the middle of the sentence. She turned the lights out behind the counter, and she and the other waitresses almost ran to the back of the store, deserting all their white customers. I guess they thought that violence would start immediately after the whites at the counter realized what was going on. There were 5 or 6 other people at the counter. A couple of them just got up and walked away. A girl sitting next to me finished her banana split before leaving. A middle-aged white woman who had not yet been served rose from her seat and came over to us.
"I'd like to stay here with you," she said, "but my husband is waiting."
The newsmen came in just as she was leaving. They must have discovered what was going on shortly after some of the people began to leave the store. One of the newsmen ran behind the woman who spoke to us and asked her to identify herself. She refused to give her name, but said she was a native of Vicksburg and a former resident of California. When asked why she had said what she had said to us, she replied,
"I am in sympathy with the Negro movement."
By this time, a crowd of cameramen and reporters had gathered around us taking pictures and asking questions such as, "Where are we from? Why did we sit in? What organization sponsored it? Were we students? From what school? How were we classified?" I told them that we were all students at Tougaloo College, that we were represented by no particular organization, and that we planned to stay there even after the store closed.
"All we want is service," was my reply to one of them.
After they had finished probing for about 20 minutes, they were almost ready to leave. At noon, students from a nearby white high school started pouring into Woolworths. When they first saw us, they were sort of surprised. They didn't know how to react. A few started to heckle, and the newsmen became interested again. Then, the white students started chanting all kinds of anti-Negro slogans. We were called a little bit of everything. The rest of the seats, except the 3 we were occupying, had been roped off to prevent others from sitting down. A couple of the boys took one end of the rope and made it into a hangman's noose. Several attempts were made to put it around our necks. The crowds grew as more students and adults came in for lunch. We kept our eyes straight forward and did not look at the crowd except for occasional glances to see what was going on. All of a sudden, I saw a face I remembered, the drunkard from the bus station sit-in. My eyes lingered on him just long enough for us to recognize each other. Today he was drunk too, so I don't think he remembered where he had seen me before. He took out a knife, opened it, put it in his pocket, and then began to pace the floor. At this point, I told Memphis and Perlina what was going on. Memphis suggested that we pray. We bowed our heads, and all hell broke loose. A man rushed forward, threw Memphis from his seat, and slapped his face. Then another man who worked in the store threw me against an adjoining counter. Down on my knees on the floor, I saw Memphis lying near the lunch counter with blood running out of the corners of his mouth. As he tried to protect his face, the man who'd thrown him down kept kicking him against the head. If he had worn hard-soled shoes instead of sneakers, the first kick probably would have killed Memphis. Finally, a man dressed in plain clothes identified himself as a police officer and arrested Memphis and his attacker. Perlina had been thrown to the floor. She and I got back on our stools after Memphis was arrested. There were some white Tougaloo teachers in the crowd. They asked Perlina and me if we wanted to leave. They said that things were getting too rough. We didn't know what to do. While we were trying to make up our minds, we were joined by Joan Trumpower. Now there were 3 of us, and we were integrated. The crowd began to chant, "Communists! Communists! Communists!" Some old man in the crowd ordered the students to take us off the stools.
"Which one should I get first?"
a big husky boy said.
"That white nigger,"
the old man said. The boy lifted Joan from the counter by her waist and carried her out of the store. Simultaneously, I was snatched from my stool by two high school students. I was dragged about 30 feet toward the door by my hair when someone made them turn me loose. As I was getting up off the floor, I saw Joan coming back inside. We started back to the center of the counter to join Perlina. Lois Chaffee, a white Tougaloo faculty member, was now sitting next to her. So Joan and I just climbed across the rope at the front end of the counter and sat down. There were now four of us, two whites and two Negroes, all women. The mob started smearing us with ketchup, mustard, sugar, pies, and everything on the counter. Soon, Joan and I were joined by John Salter, but the moment he sat down, he was hit on the jaw with what appeared to be brass knuckles. Blood gushed from his face, and someone threw salt into the open wound. Ed King, Tougaloo's chaplain, rushed to him. At the other end of the counter, Lois and Perlina were joined by George Raymond, a Corps field worker and a student from Jackson State College. Then a Negro high school boy sat down next to me. The mob took spray paint from the counter and sprayed it on the new demonstrators. The high school student had on a white shirt. The word "nigger" was written on his back with red spray paint. We sat there for 3 hours taking a beating when the manager decided to close the store because the mob had begun to go wild with stuff from other counters. He begged and begged everyone to leave. But even after 15 minutes of begging, no one budged. They would not leave until we did. Then Dr. Badle, the president of Tougaloo College, came running in. He said he had just heard what was happening. About 90 policemen were standing outside the store. They had been watching the whole thing through the windows, but had not come in to stop the mob or do anything. President Badle went outside and asked Captain Ray to come and escort us out. The captain refused, stating the manager had to invite him in before he could enter the premises. So Dr. Badle himself brought us out. He had told the police that they had better protect us after we were outside the store. When we got outside, the policemen formed a single line that blocked the mob from us. However, they were allowed to throw at us everything they had collected. Within 10 minutes, we were picked up by Reverend King in his station wagon and taken to the NAACP headquarters on Lynch Street. After the sit-in, all I could think of was how sick Mississippi whites were. They believed so much in the segregated Southern way of life, they would kill to preserve it. I sat there in the NAACP office and thought of how many times they had killed when this way of life was threatened. I knew that the killing had just begun. Many more will die before it is over with, I thought. Before the sit-in, I had always hated the whites in Mississippi. Now, I knew it was impossible for me to hate sickness. The whites had a disease, an incurable disease in its final stage. What were our chances against such a disease? I thought of the students, the young Negroes who had just begun to protest as young interns. When these young interns got older, I thought, they would be the best doctors in the world for social problems. Before we were taken back to campus, I wanted to get my hair washed. It was stiff with dried mustard, ketchup, and sugar. I stopped in at a beauty shop across the street from the NAACP office. I didn't have on any shoes because I had lost them when I was dragged across the floor at Woolworths. My stockings were sticking to my legs from the mustard that had dried on them. The hairdresser took one look at me and said, "My land! You were in the sit-in, huh?" "Yes," I answered. "Do you have time to wash my hair and style it?" "Right away," she said, and she meant right away. There were three other ladies already waiting, but they seemed glad to let me go ahead of them. The hairdresser was real nice. She even took my stockings off and washed my legs while my hair was drying. There was a mass rally that night at the Pearl Street Church in Jackson, and the place was packed. People were standing two abreast in the aisles. Before the speakers began, All the sit-inners walked out on the stage and were introduced by Medgar Evers. People stood and applauded for what seemed like 30 minutes or more. Medgar told the audience that this was just the beginning of such demonstrations. He asked them to pledge themselves to unite in a massive offensive against segregation in Jackson and throughout the state. The rally ended with, "We shall overcome," and sent home hundreds of determined people. It seemed as though Mississippi Negroes were about to get together, at last. Before I demonstrated, I had written Mama. She wrote me back a letter, begging me not to take part in the sit-in. She even sent $10 for bus fare to New Orleans. I didn't have one penny, so I kept the money. Mama's letter made me mad. I had to live my life as I saw fit. I had made that decision when I left home. But it hurt to have my family prove to me how scared they were. It hurt me more than anything else. I knew the whites had already started the threats and intimidations. I was the first Negro from my hometown who had openly demonstrated, worked with the NAACP or anything. When Negroes threatened to do anything in Centerville, they were either shot, like Samuel O'Quinn, or run out of town, like Reverend Dupree. I didn't answer Mama's letter. Even if I had written one, she wouldn't have received it before she saw the news on TV or heard it on the radio. I waited to hear from her again, and I waited to hear in the news that someone in Centerville had been murdered. If so, I knew it would be a member of my family. On Wednesday, the day after the sit-in, demonstrations got off to a good start. 10 people picketed shortly after noon on Capitol Street and were arrested. Another mass rally followed the demonstrations that night, where a 6-man delegation of Negro ministers was chosen to meet Mayor Thompson the following Tuesday. They were to present to him a number of demands on behalf of Jackson Negroes. They were as follows. Hiring of Negro policemen and school crossing guards. Removal of segregation signs from public facilities. Improvement of job opportunities for Negroes on city payrolls. Negro drivers of city garbage trucks, etc. Encouraging public eating establishments to serve both whites and Negroes. Integration of public parks and libraries. The naming of a Negro to the City Parks and Recreation Committee. Integration of public schools. Forcing service stations to integrate restrooms. After this meeting, Reverend Horton, the minister of Pearl Street Church, said that the mayor was going to act on all the suggestions. But the following day, Thompson denied that he had made any promises. He said the Negro delegation got carried away following their discussion with him. "It seems as though Mayor Thompson wants to play games with us," Reverend Horton said at the next rally. "He is calling us liars and trying to make us sound like fools. I guess we have to show him that we mean business." When Reverend Charles A. Jones, dean and chaplain at Campbell College, asked at the close of the meeting, "Where do we go from here?" the audience shouted, "To the streets!" They were going to prove to Mayor Thompson and the white people of Jackson that they meant business. Around 10 the next morning, an entire day of demonstration started. A little bit of everything was tried. Some Negroes sat in, some picketed, and some squatted in the streets and refused to move. All of the 5 and 10 stores, H.L. Green, Cress, and Woolworths, had closed their lunch counters as a result of the Woolworths sit-in. However, this did not stop the new sit-ins. Chain restaurants such as Primo's Restaurant in downtown Jackson were now targets. Since police brutality was the last thing wanted in good, respectable Jackson, Mississippi, whenever arrested demonstrators refused to walk to a paddy wagon, garbage truck, or whatever was being used to take people to jail, Negro trustees from Jackson City Jail carted them away. Captain Ray and his men would just stand back with their hands folded, looking innocent as lambs for the benefit of the northern reporters and photographers. The mayor still didn't seem to be impressed with the continuous small demonstrations and kept the streets hot. After 88 demonstrators had been arrested, the mayor held a news conference where he told a group of reporters, "We can handle 100,000 agitators." He also stated that the good colored citizens are not rallying to the support of the outside agitators. Although there were only a few out-of-state people involved in the movement at the time, and offered to give northern newsmen anything they wanted, including transportation, if they would adequately report the facts. During the demonstrations, I helped conduct several workshops where potential demonstrators, high school and college students mostly, were taught to protect themselves. If, for instance, you wanted to protect the neck to offset a karate blow, you clasped your hands behind the neck. To protect the genital organs, you doubled up in a knot, drawing the knees up to the chest to protect your breasts if you were a girl. The workshops were handled mostly by SNCC and Corps field secretaries and workers, almost all of whom were very young. The NAACP handled all the bail and legal services and public relations, but SNCC and Corps could draw teenagers into the movement as no other organization could. Whether they received credit for it or not, they helped make Jackson the center of attention throughout the nation. During this period, civil rights workers who had become known to the Jackson police were often used to divert the cops' attention just before a demonstration. A few cops were always placed across the street from NAACP headquarters, since most of the demonstrations were organized there and would leave from that building. The diverters would get into cars and lead the cops off on a wild goose chase. This would allow the real demonstrators to get downtown before they were noticed. One evening, a group of us took the cops for a tour of the park. After giving the demonstrators time enough to get to Capitol Street, we decided to go and watch the action. When we arrived there ourselves, we met Reverend King and a group of ministers. They told us they were going to stage a pray-in on the post office steps. "Come on, join us," Reverend King said. "I don't think we'll be arrested because it's federal property." By the time we got to the post office, the newsmen had already been informed, and a group of them were standing in front of the building, blocking the front entrance. By now, the group of whites that usually constituted the mob had gotten smart. They no longer looked for us or for the demonstration. They just followed the newsmen and photographers. They were much smarter than the cops, who hadn't caught on yet. We entered the post office through the side entrance and found that part of the mob was waiting inside the building. We didn't let this bother us. As soon as a few more ministers joined us, we were ready to go outside. There were 14 of us, 7 whites and 7 Negroes. We walked out front and stood and bowed our heads as the ministers began to pray. We were immediately interrupted by the appearance of Captain Ray. "We are asking you people to disperse. If you don't, you are under arrest," he said. Most of us were not prepared to go to jail. Doris Erskine, a student from Jackson State, and I had to take over a workshop the following day. Some of the ministers were in charge of the mass rally that night, but if we had dispersed, we would have been torn to bits by the mob. The whites standing out there had murder in their eyes. They were ready to do us in, and all 14 of us knew that. We had no other choice but to be arrested. We had no plan of action. Reverend King and some of the ministers who were kneeling refused to move. They just kept on praying. Some of the others also attempted to kneel. The rest of us just walked to the paddy wagon. Captain Ray was using the Negro trustees. I felt so sorry for them. They were too small to be carrying all these heavy-ass demonstrators. I could tell just by looking at them that they didn't want to either. I knew they were forced to do this. After we got to jail, we were mugged and fingerprinted, then taken to a cell. Most of the ministers were scared stiff. This was the first time some of them had seen the inside of a jail. Before we were mugged, we were all placed in a room together and allowed to make one call. Reverend King made the call to the NAACP headquarters to see if some of the ministers could be bailed out right away. I was so glad when they told him they didn't have money available at the moment. I just got my kicks out of sitting there looking at the ministers. Some of them looked so pitiful. I thought they would cry any minute, and here they were, supposed to be our leaders. When Doris and I got to the cell where we would spend the next 4 days, we found a lot of our friends there. There were 12 girls all together. The jail was segregated. I felt sorry for Jeanette King, Lois Chaffee, and Joan Trumpower. Just because they were white, they were missing out on all the fun we planned to have. Here we were going to school together, sleeping in the same dorm, worshiping together, playing together, even demonstrating together. It all ended in jail. They were rushed off by themselves to some cell designated for whites. Our cell didn't even have a curtain over the shower. Every time the cops heard the water running, they came running to peep. After the first time, we fixed them. We took chewing gum and toilet tissue and covered the opening in the door. They were afraid to take it down. I guess they thought it might have come out in the newspaper. Their wives wouldn't have liked that at all. Peep through a hole to see a bunch of nigger girls naked? No, no, they certainly wouldn't have liked that. All of the girls in my cell were college students. We had a lot to talk about, so we didn't get too bored. We made cards out of toilet tissue and played gin rummy almost all day. Some of us even learned new dance steps from each other. There were a couple of girls in with us from Jackson State College. They were scared they would be expelled from school. Jackson State, like most of the state-supported Negro schools, was an Uncle Tom school. The students could be expelled for almost anything. When I found this out, I really appreciated Tougaloo. The day we were arrested, one of the Negro trustees sneaked us a newspaper. We discovered that over 400 high school students had also been arrested. We were so glad. We sang freedom songs for an hour or so. The jailer threatened to put us in solitary if we didn't stop. At first, we didn't think he meant it, so we kept singing. He came back with two other cops and asked us to follow them. They marched us down the hall and showed us one of the solitary chambers. "If you don't stop that damn singing, I'm gonna throw all of you in here together," said the jailer. After that, we didn't sing anymore. We went back and finished reading the paper. We got out of jail on Sunday to discover that everyone was talking about the high school students. All 400 who were arrested had been taken to the fairgrounds and placed in a large open compound without beds or anything. It was said that they were getting sick like flies. Mothers were begging to have their children released, but the NAACP didn't have enough money to bail them all out. The same day we went to jail for the pray-in, the students at Lanier High School had started singing freedom songs on their lunch hour. They got so carried away, they ignored the bell when the break was over and just kept on singing. The principal of the high school did not know what to do, so he called the police and told them that the students were about to start a riot. When the cops came, they brought the dogs. The students refused to go back to their classrooms when asked, so the cops turned the dogs loose on them. The students fought them off for a while. In fact, I was told that mothers who lived near the school had joined the students in fighting off the dogs. They had begun to throw bricks, rocks, and bottles. The next day, the paper stated that 10 or more cops suffered cuts or minor wounds. The papers didn't say it, but a lot of students were hurt too, from dog bites and lumps on the head from billy clubs. Finally, 150 cops were rushed to the scene, and several students and adults were arrested. The next day, 400 of the high school students from Lanier, Jim Hill, and Brinkley High Schools gathered in a church on Farish Street, ready to go to jail. Willie Ludden, the NAACP youth leader, and some of the SNCC and CORE workers met with them, gave a brief workshop on nonviolent protective measures, and led them into the streets. After marching about two blocks, they were met by helmeted police officers and ordered to disperse. When they refused, they were arrested, herded into paddy wagons, canvas-covered trucks, and garbage trucks. Those moving too slowly were jabbed with rifle butts. Police dogs were there, but were not used. From the way everyone was describing the scene, it sounded like Nazi Germany instead of Jackson, USA. On Monday, I joined a group of high school students and several other college students who were trying to get arrested. Our intention was to be put in the fairgrounds with the high school students already there. The cops picked us up, but they didn't want to put us so-called professional agitators in with the high school students. We were weeded out and taken back to the city jail. I got out of jail 2 days later and found I had gotten another letter from Mama. She had written it Wednesday the 29th after the Woolworth sit-in. The reason it had taken so long for me to get it was that it came by way of New Orleans. Mama sent it to Adeline and had Adeline mail it to me. In the letter, she told me that the sheriff had stopped by and asked all kinds of questions about me the morning after the sit-in. She said she and Raymond told them that I had only been home once since I was in college, that I had practically cut off all my family connections when I ran away from home as a senior in high school. She said he said that he knew I had left home. He should know, I thought, because I had to get him to move my clothes for me when I left. She went on and on. She told me he said I must never come back there. If so, he would not be responsible for what happened to me. The whites are pretty upset about her doing these things, he told her. Mama told me not to write her again until she sent me word that it was okay. She said that I would hear from her through Adeline. I also got a letter from Adeline in the same envelope. She told me what Mama hadn't mentioned, that Junior had been cornered by a group of white boys and was about to be lynched, when one of his friends came along in a car and rescued him. Besides that, a group of white men had gone out and beaten up my old Uncle Buck. Adeline said Mama told her they couldn't sleep for fear of night riders. They were all scared to death. My sister ended the letter by cursing me out. She said I was trying to get every Negro in Centerville murdered. I guess Mama didn't tell me these things because she was scared too. She probably thought I would have tried to do something crazy. Something like trying to get the organizations to move into Wilkinson County, or maybe coming home myself to see if they would kill me. She never did give me credit for having the least bit of sense. I knew there was nothing I could do. No organization was about to go to Wilkinson County. It was a little too tough for any of them, and I wasn't about to go there either. If they said they would kill me, I figured I'd better take their word for it. Meantime, within 4 or 5 days, Jackson became the hotbed of racial demonstrations in the South. It seemed as though most of the Negro college and high school students there were making preparations to participate. Those who did not go to jail were considered cowards by those who did. At this point, Mayor Alan Thompson finally made a decisive move. He announced that Jackson had made plans to house over 12,500 demonstrators at the local jails and at the state fairgrounds. And if this was not enough, he said, Parchman, the state penitentiary, 160 miles away, would be used. Governor Ross Barnett had held a news conference offering Parchman facilities to Jackson. An injunction prohibiting demonstrations was issued by a local judge, naming NAACP, Corps, Tougaloo College, and various leaders. According to this injunction, the intent of the named organizations and individuals was to paralyze the economic nerve center of the city of Jackson. It used as proof the leaflets that had been distributed by the NAACP, urging Negroes not to shop on Capitol Street. The next day, the injunction was answered with another mass march. The cops started arresting every Negro on the scene of a demonstration, whether or not he was participating. People were being carted off to jail every day of the week. On Saturday, Roy Wilkins, the national director of NAACP, and Medgar Evers were arrested as they picketed in front of Woolworths. Teldon Henderson, a Negro lawyer who worked for the Justice Department and had been sent down from Washington to investigate a complaint by the NAACP about the fairgrounds facilities, was also arrested. It was said that when he showed his Justice Department credentials, the arresting officer started trembling. They let him go immediately. Mass rallies had come to be an every-night event, and at each one, the NAACP had begun to build up Medgar Evers. Somehow, I had the feeling that they wanted him to become for Mississippi what Martin Luther King had been in Alabama. They were well on the way to achieving that, too. After the rally on Tuesday, June 11th, I had to stay in Jackson. I had missed the ride back to campus. Dave Dennis, the Corps Field Secretary for Mississippi, and his wife put me up for the night. We were watching TV around 12:30 when a special news bulletin interrupted the program. It said, Jackson NAACP leader Medgar Evers has just been shot. We didn't believe what we were hearing. We just sat there staring at the TV screen. It was unbelievable. Just an hour or so earlier, we were all with him. The next bulletin announced that he had died in the hospital soon after the shooting. We didn't know what to say or do. All night we tried to figure out what had happened, who did it, who was next, and it still didn't seem real. First thing the next morning, we turned on the TV. It showed films taken shortly after Medgar was shot in his driveway. We saw the pool of blood where he had fallen. We saw his wife sobbing almost hysterically as she tried to tell what had happened. Without even having breakfast, we headed for the NAACP headquarters. When we got there, they were trying to organize a march to protest Medgar's death. Newsmen, investigators, and reporters flooded the office. College and high school students and a few adults sat in the auditorium waiting to march. Dory Ladner, a SNCC worker, and I decided to run up to Jackson State College and get some of the students there to participate in the march. I was sure we could convince some of them to protest Medgar's death. Since the march was to start shortly after lunch, we had a couple of hours to do some recruiting. When we got to Jackson State, class was in session. That's a damn shame, I thought. They should have dismissed school today in honor of Medgar. Dory and I started going down each hall, taking opposite classrooms. We begged students to participate. They didn't respond in any way. It's a shame. It really is a shame. This morning, Medgar Evers was murdered, and here you sit in a damn classroom with books in front of your faces, pretending you don't even know he's been killed. Every Negro in Jackson should be in the streets raising hell and protesting his death. I said in one class, I felt sick. I got so mad with them. How could Negroes be so pitiful? How could they just sit by and take all this shit without any emotions at all? I just didn't understand. It's hopeless, Moody. Let's go, Dory said. As we were leaving the building, we began soliciting aloud in the hall. We walked right past the president's office, shouting even louder. President Reddix came rushing out.
"You girls leave this campus immediately," he said. "You can't come on this campus and announce anything without my consent."
Dory had been a student at Jackson State. Mr. Reddix looked at her.
"You know better than this, Dory," he said.
"But President Reddix, Medgar was just murdered. Don't you have any feelings about his death at all?" Dory said.
"I am doing a job. I can't do this job and have feelings about everything happening in Jackson," he said.
He was waving his arms and pointing his finger in our faces.
"Now you two get off this campus before I have you arrested."
By this time, a group of students had gathered in the hall. Dory had fallen to her knees in disgust as Reddix was pointing at her, and some of the students thought he had hit her. I didn't say anything to him. If I had, I would have been calling him every kind of fucking Tom I could think of. I helped Dory off the floor. I told her we'd better hurry, or we would miss the demonstration. On our way back to the auditorium, we picked up the Jackson Daily News. Headlines read, "Jackson Integration Leader Evers Slain." "Negro NAACP leader Medgar Evers was shot to death when he stepped from his automobile here early today as he returned home from an integration strategy meeting. Police said Evers, 37, was cut down by a high-powered bullet in the back of the driveway of his home." I stopped reading. Medgar was usually followed home every night by two or three cops. Why didn't they follow him last night? Something was wrong. They must have known, I thought. Why didn't they follow him last night? I kept asking myself. I had to get out of all this confusion. The only way I could do it was to go to jail. Jail was the only place I could think in. When we got back to the auditorium, we were told that those who would take part in the first march had met at Pearl Street Church. Dory and I walked over there. We noticed a couple of girls from Jackson State. They asked Dory if President Reddix had hit her and said it had gotten out on campus that he had. They told us a lot of students had planned to demonstrate because of what Reddix had done.
"Good enough," Dory said. "Reddix better watch himself, or we'll turn that school out."
I was called to the front of the church to help lead the marchers in a few freedom songs. We sang, "Woke up early this morning with my mind on freedom," and "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me round." After singing the last song, we headed for the streets in a double line, carrying small American flags in our hands. The cops had heard that there were going to be Negroes in the streets all day protesting Medgar's death. They were ready for us. On Rose Street, we ran into a blockade of about 200 policemen. We were called to a halt by Captain Ray and asked to disperse.
"Everybody ain't got a permit. Get out of this here parade," Captain Ray said into his bullhorn.
No one moved. He beckoned to the cops to advance on us. The cops had rifles and wore steel helmets. They walked right up to us very fast and then sort of engulfed us. They started snatching the small American flags, throwing them to the ground, stepping on them, or stamping them. Students who refused to let go of the flags were jabbed with rifle butts. There was only one paddy wagon on the scene. The first 20 of us were thrown into it, although a paddy wagon is only large enough to seat about 10 people. We were sitting and lying all over each other inside the wagon when garbage trucks arrived. We saw the cops stuff about 50 demonstrators in one truck as we looked out through the back glass. Then the driver of the paddy wagon sped away as fast as he could, often making sudden stops in the middle of the street so we would be thrown around. We thought that they were going to take us to the city jail again because we were college students. We discovered we were headed for the fairgrounds. When we got there, the driver rolled up the windows, turned the heater on, got out, closed the door, and left us. It was over 100 degrees outside that day. There was no air coming in. Sweat began dripping off us. An hour went by. Our clothes were now soaked and sticking to us. Some of the girls looked as though they were about to faint. A policeman looked in to see how we were taking it. Some of the boys begged him to let us out. He only smiled and walked away. Looking out of the back window again, we noticed they were now booking all the other demonstrators. We realized they had planned to do this to our group. A number of us in the paddy wagon were known to the cops. After the Woolworths sit-in, I had been known to every white in Jackson. I can remember walking down the street and being pointed out by whites as they drove or walked past me. Suddenly, one of the girls screamed. Scrambling to the window, we saw John Salter with blood gushing out of a large hole in the back of his head. He was just standing there dazed and no one was helping him, and we were in no position to help either. After they let everyone else out of the garbage trucks, they decided to let us out of the paddy wagon. We had now been in there well over 2 hours. As we were getting out, some of the girls almost fell. A guy started to help her.
"Get your hands off that gal. What do you think, you're going to a prom or something?"
one of the cops said. Water was running down my legs. My skin was soft and spongy. I had hidden a small transistor radio in my bra, and some of the other girls had cards and other things in theirs. We had learned to sneak them in after we discovered they didn't search the women, but now everything was showing through our wet clothes. When we got into the compound, there were still some high school students there, since the NAACP bail money had been exhausted. There were altogether well over 150 in the girls' section. The boys had been put into a compound directly opposite and parallel to us. Some of the girls who had been arrested after us shared their clothes with us until ours dried. They told us what had happened after we were taken off in the paddy wagon. They said the cops had stuffed so many into the garbage trucks that some were just hanging on. As one of the trucks pulled off, 13-year-old John Young fell out. When the driver stopped, the truck rolled back over the boy. He was rushed off to a hospital, and they didn't know how badly he had been hurt. They said the cops had gone wild with their billy sticks. They had even arrested Negroes looking on from their porches. John Salter had been forced off some Negro's porch and hit on the head. The fairgrounds were everything I had heard they were. The compounds they put us in were two large buildings used to auction off cattle during the annual state fair. They were about a block long with large openings about 20 feet wide on both ends where the cattle were driven in. The openings had been closed up with wire. It reminded me of a concentration camp. It was hot and sticky, and girls were walking around half-dressed all the time. We were guarded by 4 policemen. They had rifles and kept an eye on us through the wired sides of the building. As I look through the wire at them, I imagine myself in Nazi Germany, the policemen Nazi soldiers. They couldn't have been any rougher than these cops. Yet this was America, the land of the free and the home of the brave. About 5:30, we were told that dinner was ready. We were lined up single file and marched out of the compound. They had the cook from the city jail there. He was standing over a large garbage can stirring something in it with a stick. The sight of it nauseated me. No one was eating, girls or boys. In the next few days, many were taken from the fairgrounds, sick from hunger. When I got out of jail on Saturday, the day before Medgar's funeral, I had lost about 15 pounds. They had prepared a special meal on campus for the Tougaloo students, but attempts to eat made me sicker. The food kept coming up. The next morning, I pulled myself together enough to make the funeral services at the Masonic Temple. I was glad I had gone in spite of my illness. This was the first time I had ever seen so many Negroes together. There were thousands and thousands of them there. Maybe Medgar's death had really brought them to the movement, I thought. Maybe his death would strengthen the ties between Negroes and Negro organizations. If this resulted, then truly, his death was not in vain. Just before the funeral services were over, I went outside. There was a hill opposite the Masonic Temple. I went up there to watch the procession. I wanted to see every moment of it. As the pallbearers brought the body out and placed it in a hearse, the tension in the city was as tight as a violin string. There were 2,000 or 3,000 outside that could not get inside the temple, and as they watched, their expression was that of anger, bitterness, and dismay. They looked as though any moment they were going to start rioting. When Mrs. Evers and her 2 older children got into their black limousine, Negro women in the crowd began to cry and say things like, "That's a shame. That's a young woman. Such well-looking children. It's a shame. It really is a shame." Negroes formed a seemingly endless line as they began the march to the funeral home. They got angrier and angrier. However, they went on quietly until they reached the downtown section where the boycott was.